uneasy, she stopped, trying to make sense of the cacophony she could hear from the earbud. The rapid rat-tat-tat of automatic weapons in the distance died down. Anxiously, she waited, her heart pounding, sweat pouring off her. Please, God. Oh, please, let them be all right. At Babe's two sharp words, "Ambush! Ambush!" they all hit the ground. Simultaneously behind them was a boom, and Levi snapped a look over his shoulder to see, in the distance, a spreading glow exactly where the ruin would have been. The internal shockwave that hit him was staggering. Gina. Before he could process anything else, Yasser wheeled, holding a weapon he must have had hidden beneath his loose clothing, and began firing as he ran to the side. Yasser didn't have an NVD, so he was shooting wildly toward where he thought Levi's team was, which came close enough. A bullet zinged overhead with an angry whine. Levi rolled, aimed, and stitched a line of shots across Yasser's torso. The man staggered, shook, went down. He twitched a time or two, then was still. Not taking anything for granted, both Levi and Trapper took almost simultaneous headshots at Yasser. Careless people got killed by other people who weren't quite dead yet. Levi wasn't careless, and Yasser was now completely dead. Gina. He did a quick surveillance and saw nothing. Urgently surged to his feet. Had Gina been telling them there was an ambush at the ruin, or warning them of Yasser? Maybe both. Already moving, he jerked his NVD up and started in the direction of the ruin. Even at this distance, the glow had become a noticeable fire, pulsing skyward, bright enough to have blinded him if he'd kept the NVD in place. The entire team was on their feet, looking back toward the fire. Another shot, this one from the direction where the informant had been hiding. They hit the ground again. Cursing silently, Levi pulled his NVD back into place. The white flare of muzzle flashes revealed the location of the new attackers. They were running, advancing fast. The good news was that drastically affected their accuracy, which in his experience wasn't great anyway. It was more blast away until they ran out of cartridges. The bad news was that the team was outnumbered by at least 2-1. He began squeezing off shots, carefully placing the rounds for maximum effectiveness, moving after each shot, because his muzzle flash revealed his position too. The rest of the team was returning fire, doing the same thing he was doing, looking for what cover they could find before the attackers overran them. They scrambled, looking for indentations in the terrain, a pile of rocks, anything. He saw Voodoo get hit, go down, get up and keep moving. Then some of the attackers began diving for cover too, proving that they had at least some training. Shit. He was pinned down by these assholes when every cell of his body was being eaten by urgency to get back to Gina. Never before, never, had he had to force himself to concentrate during a firefight. By his count, 6 attackers are down and unmoving, 7 if he counted Yasser. There were 9 more, unless a couple had hung back to maybe flank them and come up behind them. He did a swift check of his 6, clear, and also checked on Voodoo, who signaled a thumbs up. Using hand signals, Levi sent Jelly and Crutch snaking around to the left. He and Boom shifted to the right, not too much. Didn't want to get in the line of fire from Jelly and Crutch. Snake and Trapper, along with Voodoo, held the middle. But Voodoo was a worry, despite the thumbs up, because Levi didn't know how mobile his man was.
"Let's take care of these fuckers," he said. "Report."
Levi's voice. Even though her hearing was still muffled, she recognized that rough tone, and tears of relief sprang to her eyes. She wiped them on her grimy sleeve, then had to blink away the dust. She thought she'd heard him say something before, but the sound had been garbled.
"Crutch and Voodoo are down."
That was Snake. Ah, no, 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 no. Down didn't mean dead, but they were a long way from the secondary pickup point, and that wasn't good. One by one the team reported, except for Crutch and Voodoo. Then Levi spoke again.
"Babe, report in."
She tried. She clicked the mic, said, "Here," but the silence met her effort. She tried again, then faced facts. She couldn't. Automatically, she reached for her holster so she could fire a shot to let them know her location. She'd also be alerting the bad guys who might or might not still be at the ruins, but that couldn't be helped. And her hand slapped an empty holster. Damn it, damn it. Why had she ever taken it from the holster? She felt uneasy, yeah, and with good reason. But she wished she'd ignored that impulse.
Babe!
His tone was sharp now.
Report in! Shit,
Boom said softly a few seconds later.
Trapper and I will go back. No.
Levi cut Jelly off.
She might be alive. Snake, what are their conditions?
Again, Levi's voice overrode Jelly's.
Crutch has an abdominal. Voodoo was hitting the leg and upper right torso. They're both bad. Find something to make letters. We're carrying them out of here.
There was both ice and steel in Levi's tone.
Snake, do what you can to stabilize them. We have to move fast. Ace.
That was Boom, his voice shaking a little. Then it steadied.
Do what he said, guys, and double time it.
But I'm here, Gina whispered into the night. Don't leave me. 20. Gina scrambled out of the wadi, no longer caring if she was exposed to anyone at the ruin who might have been looking for her. The fire had burned down to a much smaller blaze now, and was farther off than she'd thought it would be. Wildly, she looked around, but without Tweety and the laptop, she couldn't pinpoint the guy's location, and without night vision goggles, she had only the starlight to see by. She could hear the guys in her ear, as if she was there with them. They made litters with the materials they had at hand, scavenged from the bodies of those they'd been in the firefight with, and with an impossibly short length of time, they were moving. Boom and Jelly were carrying Voodoo, Snake and Trapper were carrying Crutch, and Levi was on point. They would swap out positions to give each of them in turn a rest. She tried yelling, only to find that the dust she'd inhaled had scratched her throat so much she couldn't get much volume. They were too far away to hear anyway, but she tried. They were gone. They were gone. She was left alone. They'd left her. The realization was like a knife slicing into her gut. Knowing why they had, two of the team were seriously wounded, and they had to get them out. That was accepted by her logic. Her heart, though, felt as if a giant hand was squeezing her. They left her behind, hadn't even sent someone back to check. She was the least valuable member of the team. Knowing that and feeling it were two different things, and feeling it was shattering. Despite the heat, her teeth chattered, and her breath hitched in her throat. They thought she was likely dead, but they hadn't checked, and now she would die. She had no weapon, no water, no shelter. She would die out here tomorrow, or the next day, assuming someone didn't capture her, and she thought she'd rather die first, all things considered. Mom. The single word echoed in her brain, brought all of them, her family, into sharp focus. They would never know exactly what happened to her, never have a body to bury. At best, they'd be told that her remains were unrecoverable. But the guys hadn't even tried. They'd left her behind. No, she had to get past that, push it away. She couldn't just stand here and wait to die. She had to do something, and she couldn't function if she let herself get sucked into despair. They'd done what they had to do. Now she had to do what she had to do. Inaction wasn't an option. She refused to accept defeat, refused to give up. She had a chance, because she knew where they were going, knew the coordinates of the secondary exfil point. Willfully, she fought down the thought-clouding panic. She needed every brain cell she had to get out of this alive.
Not only did she know where they were going, but she had that damn compass in her cargo pocket, because months ago, almost a year now, they had insisted she learn it, use it, keep it with her. Because sometimes phones and GPS didn't work.
Like now. I can do this, she said aloud, and hoped she wasn't lying to herself. Cautiously, she slid back down into the wadi and pulled out her little penlight, something else the guys had impressed on her to always keep with her. Not in a bag, not nearby, but with her, just like the compass. They might have left her behind, but perhaps they'd also given her the means to survive. She had to plot her course. She had nothing to write on other than the ground, and her finger to scratch in the sand with. But she could do this. She opened the compass, figured the variables, and set her course, as much in her head as in the scratching on the ground. Then she stood and rubbed her boot over the scratches, because she didn't want to give anyone who might look for her in the morning, in daylight, an idea where she had gone. If she let herself think about what she had to do, she'd be defeated before she even started, because this was so much more than she'd ever asked of herself before. She took some deep breaths, both calming herself and gearing up for what she had to do, then climbed out of the wadi again and set out across the desert in a trot. Panic lurked, nipping at her heels. She wanted to run. She wanted to set a blistering pace across the sand, but she couldn't. She shoved it down, forced herself to focus on what was real, on the now, and perhaps the next 5 minutes. If she thought about the future or the what-ifs, then she was done. Reality was that she was in the dark, and she didn't dare turn on the penlight to see better, because not only would she use up the battery way before daylight, but if any unfriendlies were out there, the light would pinpoint her location for them. Light was visible for long distances, even tiny pinpoints of light. But what if the guys were close enough they could see the light, too? Would they investigate? They might shoot her. They had their NVDs, but the range of their weapons was greater than the visual range of the NVDs. There was no safe way to reunite with them en route. She had to get to the secondary location. She had to keep going. Focus, push, keep going. Set a steady, easy pace, and keep going. The heat and the night and the wind pressed down on her. Even at a trot, soon sweat was pouring off her. Her lungs burned. Her mouth was caught and dry. No matter how easy the pace, in this kind of heat she needed water. Water that she didn't have and had no way of finding. Without water, she had no chance of surviving the daytime heat. Do this or die. Do this or die. She stepped on a rock that slid out from under her foot, and she went down, sprawled on the sandy, rocky ground. Her fingerless gloves protected her palms, but her knees scraped. She ignored the pain, got up, resumed her pace. She didn't let herself think. This was big, maybe bigger than she could handle, and if she got caught in the details, she'd falter. She had to be a machine. She had to run the way she'd trained to run, beyond how she'd trained, because this was farther than she'd ever run before. This was hours and hours in the dark, in the heat, unable to avoid pitfalls or vipers or anything else. One of those weird rabbit kangaroo rats. What had Mamoon called it? She couldn't remember. Might jump on her and trip her. Don't think, Gina. Don't worry about the rat. Just move. Keep moving. Was she still alive? The possibility, slim as it was, ate at his guts. Levi set a brutal pace when he was on point, driven by the need to move, to get his men to safety and good medical care before it was too late, before they were carrying two corpses instead of two teammates. The faster he got to the pickup point, the sooner he could go back. He had to. He had to find her. Even if she hadn't survived, he had to bring her body back. No man left behind. No woman, either. That was the creed he'd operated under when he was in the military. And nothing had changed when he joined the go-teams. He wouldn't leave her for the jackals, the rats. Only Voodoo and Crutch, saving them, kept him focused. Every time he thought about Gina, hearing the explosion and seeing the fire glow in the distance, he nearly buckled under the despair that gutted him. He hadn't kept her safe. He'd done what he thought he had to do, for the cohesion of the team, and kept her at a distance, always thinking that things would change, that he'd have time later to explore this thing between them. Now it was too late. She was gone. All the things he thought he'd have time for, holding her and laughing with her, fighting with her, those were gone with her.
Hold up,
Snake said, and did a quick check of the wounded man. Voodoo was in danger of bleeding out, and Crutch had an abdominal wound that could be fatal, even if he'd had instant medical care. The massive infection from wounds to the gut was difficult to overcome, period. Unable to help himself, Levi turned and looked behind them, as if he could conjure a small figure emerging from the night, blue and amber eyes flashing, while she called them morons for going off and leaving her. He'd left her. Boom's hand closed on his shoulder. Levi didn't look at his friend and teammate, because sometimes not looking was easier.
You couldn't have done anything, Boom said,
his tone rough with emotion.
Doesn't matter.
Guilt and regret, grief and rage and despair, all balled together in his chest until he felt as if he could barely breathe.
When we get Voodoo and Crutch on the bird, I'm going back. I'll go with you,
Boom immediately volunteered. Levi shook his head.
No, you have Teresa and the kids to go home to, so you go. The mission is done. It was an ambush. Fuck if I know how it was set up or why. You can report as well as I can. Two doubles the chance of success, Boom retorted. I can go, Trapper said. I'm not married. Or me, Jelly offered.
Snake had a savage expression on his face. Not only did he have a family too, but he had to stay with Crutch and Voodoo, keep them alive if he could. Again, Levi shook his head no.
This is on me. I won't risk any of you. I made the decision to leave her, and I'm going back for her.
The ground went out from under her. Gina gave a hoarse shriek as she tumbled down the rough side of a dry wadi. She hit hard, narrowly missed a large rock. She scrambled away from the rock, in case a snake was using it as shelter. Or maybe snakes were using the night to hunt, and shelter during the searing heat of the day. The impact hurt, but she hadn't broken any bones.
Was this the human version of having a beat-up chassis but a good motor?
She don't look like much, fellas, but she runs good.
She ran good. Hours and hours and hours of running. Legs like steel, lungs like jellyfish. Breathing hard, she decided now was a good time to recheck her course. The short rest would keep her from overtaxing her stamina. Shaking, she pulled out the compass and penlight and replotted. She'd gone a little off course, but not too bad. Okay, really, she was doing pretty good. She'd covered some ground, not as much as she'd have liked, because what she'd have liked was to be there right now, but a decent distance. What time was it? How could she not have thought of that before? She roughly estimated the distance, then looked at the luminous hands on her heavy-duty wristwatch like all the guys wore. The world's top marathoners could run that distance in 2-something hours, but she wasn't a top marathoner, and they ran in daylight, in sneakers on city streets, with people giving them water along the way. She figured her speed would be less than half that, so at best she had probably another 5 hours of running, and that was if she didn't fall and break a leg or crush her skull. Though in the case of skull crush, her worries were over. Covering that distance in 5 hours was a reasonable expectation, she thought. A nice, brisk walk would cover a mile in 15 minutes, 4 miles an hour, 20 miles in 5 hours. 5 hours would at least be nautical twilight, and she'd be able to see. What kind of time would the guys make? They were, by necessity, traveling slower, but had a shorter distance, and she knew they would push themselves to get Crutch and Voodoo to medical help as fast as possible. They were strong, they could see, and they had water. They might not be much slower. If they got to the exfil point ahead of her, Levi would call in the helicopter for pickup, and they might be gone before she could get there. It was a short hop for the helicopter, across the Iraqi border, just into Syria, then back. They wouldn't wait. As soon as the guys were on board, it would lift off. She had to go faster. She climbed out of the wadi and set off again, picking picking up the pace. The boots rubbed up and down on her feet, despite the two pairs of socks she wore. She was sweating so much her socks were damp anyway. Nothing she could do. She felt the blisters rubbing, felt the pain burning. She ran. She had to cut that time down. She ran. She fell. She got up and ran again, over and over. Her gasping breath burned in her chest, but every time she fell, she used the opportunity to recheck her course, to catch her breath. Veering off course would be disastrous. God, her feet hurt. The pain was crippling, so debilitating that tears stung her eyes, rolled down her cheeks. Furiously, she ordered herself to stop crying, because she couldn't afford to lose even that much moisture. She stopped, stood weaving back and forth. Could she pull her boots off, run barefoot? Yes, there were rocks and rough shrubs and all sorts of other things, but could that hurt worse than scrubbing her feet raw? Yes, it could. Her feet were already raw. She could tell by the sharpness of the pain. If she tried running barefoot, she'd be inviting massive infection in her feet. Her fault. She'd grabbed the wrong boots. Run anyway. No matter what, she had to run anyway. Forget her feet. One step after another, that was all she had to do. Take the next step and the next and the next. 5 hours. She could get through 5 hours. She could focus only on the next step, the next yard, the next mile. She could because she had no choice. She ran. What was Levi thinking? Did it bother him that he'd left her behind? Was he thinking of her at all, or only about getting his wounded men to safety? She began crying again. He told her, in words so plain there was no misunderstanding, she was the least valuable member of the team, and now he'd proven it to her. How many miles? She stopped, tried to calculate how far she'd gone, but the numbers didn't make sense. She couldn't remember, but she knew the coordinates, knew the time. She felt the minutes passing, tick-tock, closer and closer, later and later. Any minute could be 1 minute too late. She concentrated, dug deeper. Her feet were agony. The next time she fell, she lay face down in the gritty sand. The sudden transition from upright to prone, so overwhelming, her entire body went limp in relief. She thought about closing her eyes and going to sleep. How blissful that would be, and how easy. Just go to sleep, forget about this pain, this spirit-breaking struggle. The temptation was so strong that she forced herself to sit up and dig the compass from her pocket. She opened it, stared at it with blurred vision, unable to make the dial make sense. Blinking hard, she tried again. Still blurred. Shit. She closed her eyes and sat, sucking in deep breaths, trying to gather her thoughts. She had to do this or she'd die. She couldn't quit. Not now. When she felt a little steadier, she opened her eyes and made herself focus. She painstakingly checked the compass, replotted her course, then did it again to make sure she had it right. Okay, she could do this. She clicked off the penlight and realized the darkness wasn't absolute any longer. The black was becoming gray, a dark gray, but still a definite lightening around her. Daylight was coming. She was running out of time. She got up and ran. Her feet pounded in time with her thoughts. I can do this. I have to do this. Left behind, left behind, left behind. Staying upright was harder now. She kept listing to the side. She stopped, sucked in air, focused once more. Don't quit, she chanted to herself under her breath. Don't quit. She'd never quit anything. She couldn't start now. She ran. Her mind felt as if she was running, but her body seemed to be rebelling, going slower and slower. Hours. How many hours had she been running? Was it 5 hours yet? She'd estimated 5 hours. That was her target. If she could keep going for the full 5 hours, she'd be there. She couldn't let herself think anything else. The dark gray became a light gray. The rocky sand took on a reddish hue, like blood. She puzzled over the color, finally realized that she could see. She wasn't running in the unending darkness now. Time had worked its unending magic and unending hell, because it was running out. Time was running out. The terrain was rougher. There was more vegetation. Not much, but enough to matter. Because that meant if the guys were close by, she might be blocked from their view. Don't quit. I won't, she promised, her tone broken, breathless. I won't. Something, a noise, barely heard over the harsh rasp of her breathing. A strange, rhythmic womp-womp that made her frown. Because it seemed familiar, but she couldn't place it. Her instinct said to keep moving, but the noise bothered her and she stopped, her head tilted as she listened to it. What was that? She'd heard it before, she knew she had. Because she'd stopped, she dragged out the compass. It was habit now. Frowning, she stared down at the dial, the reading, concentrated. The compass was wrong. She must have broken it. It said she was almost there, but she wasn't. She was still alone and in bumfuck Egypt, wherever the hell that was. No, Syria. She was in Syria, bumfuck Syria. Ha, Egypt had a better ring to it. But if the compass was broken, then she'd be here forever, because she didn't know how to find her way out. Womp, womp, womp. She looked up and saw a giant black insect thing, silhouetted against the horizon. And then it settled down to the earth. Helicopter. Her dazed brain seized on the word, screamed it at her. It was the helicopter, their helicopter. She'd made it. No, she hadn't, because she was still standing there. Clumsily, she began to run toward the helicopter, her legs not working quite right, so that she lurched more than ran. But she was moving. Wait for me, she croaked, her voice barely audible. Here, I'm here. I'm coming. Don't leave me. Please don't leave me.
21.
Hostile approaching, one of the Black Hawk gunners urgently sang out.
They had already loaded Crutch and Voodoo, and Snake was checking them. His face was tense, knowing they were on borrowed time, and things could go south for them at any minute. The whole march to the secondary pickup point had been tense, a battle against time and distance in the effort to save them, and underscored by the sick knowledge that they'd lost Babe and been forced to leave her body behind. Levi's head snapped around. He'd seen his men loaded, and he was getting ready to do what he had to do, knowing he might not ever see them again. Going back was a huge risk, with maybe a 50-50 chance of getting out alive. He'd take what water and food they had with them. He couldn't travel during the day, on foot, in heat that would likely be in the 130-degree range. He'd been awake all night, and would have to shelter during the day, get some sleep, then start out when the sun went down and the heat dissipated some. The bodies they'd left behind would have been sniffed out by the desert predators by now, and they might have gotten into the ruin. He shut that thought down fast, because he couldn't let himself go there. He'd find her, find his babe, bury her if he couldn't bring her remains out. But first they had to deal with one more piece of shit in a shit-filled mission. The gunner had brought his barrel around. Levi narrowed his eyes, gripping his own weapon, moving for cover. Then, something. Something about the distant approaching figure made him shoot his hand out, grab the barrel, and push it up.
Wait,
he muttered, staring hard through fatigue-blurred eyes. The unknown lurching toward them was small. A woman or a kid, and thin, and so completely covered with dust that making out individual features was impossible. But the clothes were not Syrian, and there seemed to be a long mop of hair swinging.
It's her,
he said, blurting the words before his brain could catch up to his mouth.
What?
Boom whirled, already halfway on the helicopter. All of them turned, staring hard at the stumbling figure approaching them. But Levi knew somehow in his gut, and relief hit him so hard he almost staggered himself. Then he was running, bent low under the whirling blades of the helicopter.
Wait, man,
the gunner said sharply, but Levi charged across the sand and rocks toward her. If anyone was chasing her, she'd need cover. If no one was chasing her, she'd need help, because she was lurching wildly, unable to keep a straight course. Boom caught up with him, and the two of them closed on her. His throat clogged, choking him with a massive wave of emotions he couldn't identify. It wasn't joy. It was as if he'd been thrown into hell and suddenly jerked back. As if his life had been over, and now it wasn't. He and Boom reached her, reached out to support her. If he hadn't known it was Gina, he wouldn't have recognized her. Her face was gaunt, coated with sweat and dust, her eyes blind and staring. It was as if she didn't see them, as if she was so focused on keeping her feet moving that she plowed right into them. Levi caught her, then caught the feeble punch she threw at him, because she was who she was, and never stopped fighting.
"Easy, babe," he said,
then dipped his knees and tilted her over his shoulder, stood upright with the slight burden of her safe in his grip. The scent of blood hit him, made his stomach twist. He and Boom loped back to the helicopter. Boom climbed in, reached out, and Levi handed her over. The helicopter had room for 11 combat personnel, or 6 stretchers. With Voodoo and Crutch on stretchers, space was tight, but there was room to lay her down.
"Leave me alone," she muttered, the words barely legible.
Levi vaulted aboard, yelled, "Go!" to the pilot, and they lifted off in a storm of dust and debris. He reached out and gripped one of her ankles, knowing what kind of shape her feet were in, to ease her boots off. She kicked out violently, her heel catching him on the shin.
"Leave me alone," she said again, her tone fierce.
Then she turned on her side with her back to them, curling up in a protective ball, and he saw her go limp. With a quick check on the two wounded, Snake scrambled over to her, shook her. She didn't respond.
"She's out,"
Levi yelled, as he swiftly began unlacing her boots. Snake put 2 fingers on her neck, checked her pulse.
"The heart rate's too fast," he yelled back.
Quickly, he pinched the back of her hand, watched the skin stay pinched.
"Dehydrated bad. We need to get some fluids in her."
Voodoo and Crutch were already getting fluids, in an effort to keep them alive until they could get to a field hospital. There were no more IV lines available. Severe dehydration was critical. She might go into cardiac arrest. Abandoning her boots, Levi grabbed one of the remaining bottles of water, poured it over her head and the back of her neck. She didn't move, even when the water ran down into her face. She couldn't swallow. She was unconscious, and she'd choke if they tried to pour water down her. Pouring it over her wasn't much, but it was all he could do to cool her down with the supplies they had. He held his hand out and Boom slapped another bottle of water into it. He slowly poured more water over her head, while Snake cut her boots off. Her socks were bloody, not just a little, but bloody from her toes up to her ankles. Snake cut the socks off too, exposed her raw and bleeding feet. There was almost no skin left on her heels or across her toes, just exposed meat.
10 minutes,
the co-pilot bellowed, aware that every minute counted. 10 minutes. They were almost there. If Voodoo and Crutch could hang on. In 10 minutes, they'd have help, blood, and antibiotics to support them while they underwent emergency surgery. In 10 minutes, someone would start an IV line, get some fluids in her before she started convulsing. 10 minutes. It felt like a lifetime. Gina woke in a white tent. She stared around, her vision blurry. She was lying down. Her tired brain deciphered that much. But she didn't know where she was, and she didn't care. She wasn't alone. She could see what seemed like a row of people. Maybe. Or maybe she was alone. She didn't care. Everything was at a distance, and that was okay. She didn't want to think or feel. She closed her eyes and drifted off again. The next time she woke, she was more aware, but still not quite with it. The white tent was gone, and there was a droning noise that annoyed her. She moved fretfully, frowned when her hand caught on something, lifted it to stare at the IV in the back of her hand. She frowned again,
because her hand was stained and dirty. A big hand caught hers, lowered it beside her. Levi crouched beside her, his face swimming into focus. He looked terrible, unshaven, dirty, his gaze somehow savage.
"You're okay," he said.
She considered that. She remembered running through the desert, remembered the desolation and despair. She remembered a lot. She just didn't care about most of it.
"Voodoo,"
she croaked.
"Crutch?"
"They're holding on. We're on our way to Germany."
That was all she needed to know. Escaping was easy, because she was tired, so very tired. She simply had to close her eyes to shut them out. And she did. 22. She was treated in a military hospital in Germany. Gina lay quietly in bed, mostly staring at the ceiling and not interested enough to even look out the window. A massive exhaustion weighed down on her, killing her desire to do anything other than breathe. Maybe she should call her mom. Vaguely, she felt as if she needed to, just to connect with someone or something again. But not only would she have to figure out how to make an international call, she'd have to talk. She didn't want to talk, not to anyone. There was an invisible wall around her, and she felt safe inside it, safe and empty and alone. Too many words would dissolve the wall, leaving her vulnerable again. Maybe she'd call later, when she could stand words again and isolation didn't feel so necessary. A brief, hard tap on the door caught her attention, followed immediately by Levi pushing the door open and entering, as if it wouldn't occur to him to wait until she said, "Come in." Maybe he knew she wouldn't say it. More likely, he simply didn't care. He looked better than he had on the flight. He'd showered, shaved, had on clean clothes, and had gotten some sleep. The expression in his eyes was still not civilized. Something angry and violent lurked just below the surface, bubbling against his iron control. She wanted to be left alone. Why was he here? She didn't want him here. There was a chair for visitors, but being Levi, he didn't take it. He hitched his ass on the side of her bed, half-sitting, and bridged her body with one muscular arm braced on the other side of her hip. Now Gina moved her gaze to the window. Funny, somehow she'd expected to see the stark, desolate landscape of sun-baked Syria, and instead she saw the gray sky and a drizzle of rain on the glass. Germany. She was in Germany. Her body was here, but her mind hadn't caught up.
"They're both out of surgery," he said after a long moment of waiting for her to look at him.
She could feel him willing her to obey his will, as if he could use some Jedi mind trick on her eyeballs.
Crutch. Voodoo. For them, she slowly turned her head, looked at him.
"Will they make it?"
Her voice was thin and scratchy, her throat still dry feeling, despite all the fluids that had been pumped into her.
"Touch and go."
He scrubbed a hand over his face.
"They're both in ICU. Voodoo has a better shot than Crutch, but he took a lot of damage to his leg."
She nodded, and once more looked out the window. Who knew devastation felt so empty? She'd always thought it was great pain, but instead it was nothing. All emotion gone. She felt as empty as the desert, bleak and scorched.
"We're flying out in a couple of hours," he said. "We have to get back ASAP. You'll be released tomorrow, and I've arranged a flight home for you. Everything is taken care of."
She nodded again. So they were leaving her behind again. Different circumstances, and illogical on her part to think that, but there it was. They were leaving, and she wasn't. She could have traveled with them, with some help. All in all, she thought, she was in fairly good shape after going through the ordeal she'd faced. Her feet would heal. She didn't have any broken bones, and a wonderful nurse had washed her hair for her. She hadn't had a shower yet, because of her feet. But she'd washed off several times, and had finally felt clean. She'd been treated for severe dehydration, and she felt much better. Her feet were bandaged and walking wasn't fun, but she could manage to hobble around, get to the toilet by herself.
At least the catheter was out, now that they no longer needed to measure her urine output to make certain her kidneys hadn't shut down.
She could have handled the flight, gone with them, even if they were hitching a ride on another cargo plane. Instead, he'd opted to leave her to fly by herself, 24 hours later. Been there, done that, forget the damn t-shirt because she didn't want it. He took her hand, the one that didn't have the IV needle in it, rubbed his thumb across the backs of her fingers.
I'd take you with us if I could, he said.
Sure.
That's okay. She pulled her hand free and looked down at the sheet. Why was he touching her? He shouldn't be touching her. There was no point. He needed to leave, go do whatever he was supposed to be doing. She was positive holding her hand wasn't on that list.
Can I see Crutch and Voodoo?
He paused.
I'll see if they'll let someone wheel you in.
It's okay, she said again. I'll ask a nurse. Don't do me any favors, Levi. He checked the time, then stood.
I'll see you when you get back.
He stood beside the bed, looking down at her. She could feel that Jedi thing again, compelling her to look at him. But she set her jaw and kept her gaze on the sheet. She'd already seen enough of him, so damn big and tough and battle-weary. That intense, dark gaze on her. His presence almost like a punch in the stomach. She wanted him to go. He was the one she most didn't want to see. None of the other guys had come back for her either. But Levi was the one who had kissed her and held her, and he was the one who had made the decision to leave her behind. When she thought of the others, she was okay. When faced with Levi, everything in her wanted to shut down. Because he was Levi, and his will was a force of nature, he cupped her chin in one big, rough hand and turned her face toward him. She stubbornly kept her gaze down, though it felt stupid, but neither did she feel cooperative. His thumb rubbed over her mouth, and he made an impatient sound, then bent down and pressed a quick, hard kiss to her mouth, staying just long enough to give her a touch of his tongue.
"We'll talk," he said.
Was that a promise or a threat? And strolled out, his broad shoulders barely fitting through the door. Maybe, maybe not. 3 days ago, a lifetime ago, that touch, that kiss, would have had her heart pounding and her thoughts racing around like a crazed squirrel. He'd left her behind. He'd kissed her and put his tongue in her mouth. Then he'd left her anyway. And she was so tired. She didn't want to think about anything, deal with anything. Not even that something about Levi had changed and she didn't have the energy to figure out what it was. Maybe when she got home, she'd feel more like herself. The next time a nurse came in, Gina asked about going to critical care to check on her pals.
I don't see why not, she said,
then looked at Gina's bandaged feet.
I don't think you want to walk that far on those puppies, though, so I'll see what I can do about a wheelchair just before the next visitation period.
But then she forgot, and Gina had to ask someone else. Finally, she got that wheelchair, though, and an orderly took her to the ICU. Voodoo's cubicle was first. He opened his eyes when she wheeled inside, and she almost collapsed with relief. He was pale. He had tubes running into his chest, an oxygen cannula in his nose, an IV stand strung with multiple plastic bags, and his left leg was immobilized. Still, he said,
"Hey."
He sounded heavily drugged, which he was, barely out of sedation. Hey, yourself. So far, this was a very profound conversation. His bleary gaze went to the wheelchair.
What's up with that?
Oh, I hurt my feet. Not bad. I'm going home tomorrow.
Damn boots.
Yeah, the damn boots. They won't cause any more trouble, though. They're gone. That was positively chatty of her. The most she'd said at one time in... Had it really only been a day? A little more than a day? She felt as if weeks had passed. He lifted a hand, reached for her. She rolled closer and took it.
I was mostly out, he said with difficulty. But I know you were...
The words drifted off, then he rallied and finished.
Glad you're all right.
I made it. Now you have to make it too. She laid his hand back on the bed.
Planning on it.
A barely there smile touched his mouth. He lifted his hand again, made a fist. She smiled too, as she fist-bumped him. See you back home, buddy. She rolled herself down the corridor to where Crutch was. He was asleep, or unconscious. Gina watched him for a minute. He was breathing regularly, but his temp was 103, and his blood pressure was up. Crutch had gone long hours before he was treated with anything but the most basic care. He was strong, but it was still touch and go. Looking at him, looking at Voodoo, she didn't know if either of them would ever be able to rejoin the team. Life changed on a dime. Even people who lived ordinary lives were at the whim of chance. An auto accident, a fall, a walk in the wrong place at the wrong time, and nothing was ever the same again. For them, the members of the Go Teams, fate was tempted every time they answered the phone. Donnelly was dead. Voodoo and Crutch had come close. She herself had come through the disastrous mission without any lasting harm, but the balance could so easily have tipped the other way, and she could have died in the Syrian desert. She'd been terrified during the parachute training, at the time more than half convinced she wouldn't survive. But that had been a walk in the park compared to the desert. Another mile, even another half mile, and she wouldn't have made it. 5 more minutes, and she wouldn't have made it. The helicopter would have lifted off, and she wouldn't have been on it. The orderly stopped chatting with the ICU nurses and took her back to her room. Once more lying in bed, her feet aching, she looked out the window and thought about the mission. A spark of interest lit, and she seized on it with relief, glad to feel something other than sad emptiness. When she got home and talked to the others, she'd find out what they thought had happened. But she'd gone over it herself, and it was obvious Yasser and Mamoun had been hostile.
When Mamoun had seen the computer screen and realized she would be able to alert the team to the ambush, he'd gone outside and consulted with others who had been well hidden, perhaps in the very wadi she'd used for escape, but somewhere Tweety hadn't been able to see, even in infrared.
Perhaps they'd been able to contact the ambush team, or they hadn't been able to contact them, and their solution had been to set off the explosion that burned the truck and hopefully killed her, as a way to warn them something had gone wrong. Maybe they'd thought the team would immediately turn back, leaving them vulnerable to attack from the rear. She didn't know why the attack had been planned as it was, if there had truly been an informant, or if he had already been dead. There was a possibility they'd never know exactly what had happened, or why. But the Go Teams had analysts who would go through every bit of information and advance the most likely theory. In the end, she didn't have to know why. She had information from her part of the mission, what had happened and how. But she didn't know why. And in a way, she was done with it. It was as if there was a line of demarcation in her mind. And what had happened in the before didn't matter in the after. The next day, she was put on a hospital flight home. Her feet were completely wrapped in what she considered a surplus of gauze, the bandages extending halfway up her shins. She wore the shapeless paper booties surgeons wore and was taken on board the plane by wheelchair. Her feet were better, still very sore and achy, and no way would she have wanted to put on a pair of shoes. But she thought the wheelchair was a little bit of overkill, kind of like the bandages. She could have walked on board, though slowly. It was a long flight. Pretty much they all were, because the Go Teams didn't operate domestically. She slept some, read some, and still felt like crap when the plane landed at Andrews. She was rolled off the plane, then kind of abandoned while the more seriously sick or injured were unloaded. She'd been officially released, so really she'd hitched a ride on the med flight and wasn't one of the patients. She was pondering the logistics of getting home. She had no cash for a taxi. Her car was elsewhere, and she wasn't exactly in good enough shape to drive anyway while she was still on pain meds for another couple of days. She'd have to borrow a phone and call someone, although she didn't know who. Babe! She turned toward the call and saw Teresa coming toward her, a visitor's tag clipped to her blouse. A few seconds later, she was enveloped in a warm hug, and for the first time since being rescued, she felt tears sting her eyes. Fiercely, she returned the hug. I'm so glad to see you, she said into Teresa's shoulder and blinked back tears. It's my day off, so I volunteered to meet your plane, Teresa said. The guys are all tied up at headquarters.
The shit hit the fan over what happened, though Marcus has been his usual lockjawed self. And I don't know any of the operational details. Just that Voodoo and Crutch were hit bad. And your feet are hurt and you can't walk.
Your car has been collected and taken home. I've gone shopping and stocked your fridge with food. Girl, seriously, you had nothing to eat but crackers. Anyway, if you want to stay at home and rest for a few days, you can. Or if you want to get out of the house, all you have to do is call. If I didn't have to work tomorrow, I'd take you home with me. Though I figure you'd rather have peace and quiet and a chance to get yourself back. You don't know how much I appreciate this. Had Teresa somehow guessed how she felt? As a nurse, she routinely saw people who had been through traumatic experiences, so maybe she knew getting back to normal took time. Had Boom told her that she'd saved herself by running for hours on bleeding feet through the desert? She didn't want to think about that. And she didn't want to get back to normal. She preferred the disconnect. Instead, she focused on the mundane, because that was safer. She hadn't gotten as far as thinking about the food situation at home, usually lousy these days, or how she would function until she was clear to drive, which would be when she no longer needed pain medication. She could always order in pizza, she supposed, but driving would have to wait. Have you heard how Voodoo and Crutch are doing? I saw them yesterday, talked to Voodoo some, but Crutch wasn't awake. Voodoo has been upgraded from critical to serious, and if he keeps improving, he'll be moved to a regular room tomorrow. Crutch is still critical, his fever is still up, but his vitals are stabilizing.
Teresa's tone was the businesslike one of an experienced nurse.
She shook her head, her gaze worried. He has a long way to go before he's out of the woods. Whether or not either of them will be able to work again... She gave a brief tilt of her head, indicating that was unlikely. Unspoken was the reality that the team was on stand-down for the foreseeable future, at least for the missions that required full strength, because a third of the team was injured and unable. Gina thought of the team without those two, and it didn't feel right. A team was a whole, and family of sorts. Losing them would leave a huge gap. Losing her wouldn't leave as large a gap. She'd been an add-on.
She'd thought she'd become completely accepted as a teammate, but she'd been wrong.
Teresa took Gina home, fixed a sandwich for her, and made her eat. When she was satisfied that the basic needs had been met, she left and Gina tumbled into bed. She didn't care about resetting her internal clock, because she didn't have to hit the training field tomorrow. She could sleep if she wanted to. And she did. She slept for hours, woke up hungry, and hobbled her way to the kitchen to eat a cinnamon roll. Thank God Teresa had included some junk food, because even nuking some instant oatmeal was beyond her.
She went back to bed and woke up in the early hours, made some coffee, took a basin bath, and put on regular clothes.
It was good to wear something other than the hospital scrubs she'd been given in Germany. At 7 o'clock, her phone rang. She reached for it, recognized Levi's number, and jerked her hand back. But he was still her team leader, and now that she was home, there was likely debriefing to be done. Debriefing that wouldn't wait for a little thing like not being able to drive. Reluctantly, she answered.
Can you be ready in 15 minutes?
He didn't even say hello, but she gave a mental shrug. It wasn't as if she didn't know who was calling. Yes. She didn't tell him she was already dressed.
Mac is sending a car. There'll be a wheelchair.
She disconnected and wondered if 7 a.m. was too early to start drinking. She didn't feel like doing this and hated like poison to be rolled through headquarters as if she was an invalid, though technically she was an invalid. Okay, literally, she was. That didn't mean she liked it. She also didn't like wearing the paper booties, which were getting ragged anyway. So she tried to put on her only pair of bedroom slippers. Forget that. Besides, Callie had bought them for her a couple of Christmases ago, and they had moose heads bobbing on the toes. Better she wear paper booties than moose heads. 10 minutes after Levi's call, she gingerly made her way downstairs.
She couldn't flex her toes because of the bandaging, so she had to go down sideways like a toddler, clinging to the banister for balance.
The car Mac had sent pulled up to the curb just as she went outside, and the driver, a burly guy in dress pants and a polo shirt, gave her a perturbed look.
"I was coming up to get you," he said.
"How? Wheelchairs don't work on stairs," she pointed out.
"My orders were to carry you."
Carry her? She must have looked as appalled as she felt, because he mumbled something about not knowing she could walk yet. She hobbled around the car and got in the passenger seat, and hoped he wasn't chatty. He wasn't, though she could feel him giving her occasional glances, as if he was trying to size her up. When they reached headquarters, he jumped down and got the wheelchair from the trunk, unfolded it, held it steady while she transferred from the car to the seat. She already felt tired. Despite her dislike of the chair, she was happy not to be walking the distance required. He pushed her along the sidewalk up the handicap ramp, into the building where the air conditioning was already cranked up to maximum, as if trying to get a head start on the day's heat. Headquarters interior was very humdrum, deliberately so. Anyone who entered the building by accident would see a drab lobby, a single receptionist who would kindly direct them away, and two would be holding a pistol under her desk, pointing at them. The door leading back to the business part of the building was armored and accessed only by a facial recognition program and a keycard. Beyond that, the hallways seemed to have been designed by a drunk troll, though she knew they were deliberately laid out for defense. Finding her way around, when she'd first been hired, had been a challenge. After a while, she hadn't noticed the maze-like layout and navigated the building without any problem. Now she saw things with different eyes and recognized the effectiveness of the design. Every time they met someone in the hallway, whoever it was stepped to the side and stopped to stare at her. Gina began to feel uncomfortable. Was it the wheelchair? Then they met a woman who recognized her from her days in communications, though she couldn't remember the woman's name. Whoever it was stopped and said, "Gina!" Grabbing both of Gina's hands, she said, "I admire you so much. When we heard what you did, running for hours like that, well, I couldn't have done it. That was amazing." "Thank you," Gina finally managed. So that was it. Should she tell them she hadn't done anything heroic or amazing, that she'd been operating on blind desperation and the will to survive? In the end, she let it go, because doing otherwise would take too much effort, and she didn't care enough. He wheeled her to one of the secure conference rooms. Mac was there, looking as impatient and ill-tempered as always. Levi was also there, and three others, two men and a woman, who she took to be intelligence analysts.
"I have her," Levi said, taking control of the wheelchair from the driver he'd sent.
"Sure thing."
Levi pushed the chair up to the conference table, then poured a cup of coffee and set it in front of her. She murmured a thanks and was sincere about it. The coffee, anyway. No one introduced the three strangers, which didn't matter to her. She'd likely never see them again anyway. Mac paced around, scowling.
"Okay. We know this mission was in the crapper from the get-go. Ace has been debriefed. What happened on your end?"
"The kid, Mamoon, came in and watched me while I was operating the drone. I picked up a thermal signature, zoomed in on it. I thought he was amazed, interested. But now I know he was alarmed because he knew I would see the men who were waiting to ambush the team. He left, and a few minutes later I heard a voice outside, probably at the truck we were supposed to use to exfil. Whoever it was, Mamoon was talking to him. They were trying to be quiet, probably thought I couldn't hear them."
"Did you understand what they were saying?"
"No. I don't speak Arabic. Even if I did, the words weren't distinct. I could hear just enough to know there was someone with Mamoon."
"What happened next?"
I flew the drone ahead of the team's position, looking for the thermal signature of the informant. Instead, I saw a group of signatures, I'm guessing about 15. I didn't have time to count them. I immediately alerted the team to the ambush. Then the truck